When we were traveling in China 7 years ago, we attended a Christian church and it was just filled to overflowing. We were at the Nanjing Seminary and spent an hour or so with the dean. We got a very optimistic picture of the future of Christianity in China. Is that a true picture and is it still so?
When was the last visit to China, sir?
That was 7 years ago.
Oh, 7 years ago.
72, we went to church in Beijing.
Oh, I see. So 82 it was.
82.
Oh, I'm sorry. 82.
Yes, it was 82. Yes. Well, as I was sharing with you, some of you, the other morning, that after my lecture, Beijing University, last year, from March to June, I was very optimistic about the whole future of China, socio-politically, as well as from the viewpoint of the church. So I think if you got that kind of impression in 1782, it was very natural. I thought my first visit to China was 1986, together with two leaders from the Lutheran World Federation based in Geneva. But we were very well received by church leaders in those places, Nanjing, Shanghai, and Beijing. So we left China in 1986, very much encouraged by the future prospects. I'm not too sure now. I don't know whether I should mention it, but seeing that this is a Christian fellowship, I may share with you a kind of a within the fellowship, all right, of the church. The leader of the Three Self Church, Bishop K.H. Ting, could be in serious trouble. What happened was, before the June 4th crackdown, he made a very bold statement. He came all out supporting the movement. Similarly, some students at Nanjing as well as at Beijing seminaries came out in the demonstration. Now, K.H. Ting was one of the vice chairmen of the People's Political Consultative Committee. Now, I read his statement, which he made before the June 4th incident at Tiananmen Square. But since then, I have had no news in whatever media about his fate. So I'm not too sure. What I was absolutely sure was, soon after the June 4th crackdown, the Chinese government discouraged, in fact, make it a law banning the listening to foreign radios, including, of course, Voice of America, BBC, and Christian broadcasting. They make it very clear. And I saw the news and read the news in the local paper. So it is hard to predict. Yes, lots of possibilities as far as the future is concerned. Yeah.
Could you tell us about your conversion experience?
Mm. Thank you for that question. That gives me an opportunity to say a little bit more about myself. Now, as far as I can tell, perhaps in my ancestry, there was virtually no Christian contact whatsoever back in China. My grandfather came over from the southern part of China in the province of Canton about 75 years ago as a boy. So I am a Chinese brought up in diaspora in Southeast Asia, a third generation. And, you know, no contact, no Christian background whatsoever. And like many of the Chinese families in Southeast Asia, our background religiously is usually a mixture of Confucianism, which is an ethical system, and religiously more of Buddhist, Taoist inclinations, including what we call ancestor worship and the worship of idols. Now, that was my background. Mm-hmm. Well, it was not surprising at all that many of Chinese families did not have intimate contact with the Christian church or Christianity for various reasons, politically and historically. As some of you know, the Protestant mission came to China at the beginning of the 19th century, beginning with someone called Morrison, Robert Morrison, representing the London Missionary Society. Well, it came at a bad time because 19th century was a bad time. You know, the Opium War, the invasion of the so-called imperial powers. So that stigma is still very much with us. In other words, Christianity came as a foreign religion with gunpowder or gunboat diplomacy. You know, that was very bad. So bringing in my upbringing as a Chinese boy, that kind of prejudice, information we got from history was bad for Christianity. So our first encounter with the Christian mission, and in this case, a Lutheran mission, just to tell you a little bit more about the Lutheran mission, which began to operate in Malaysia and Singapore in the early 50s. Their work undoubtedly was spearheaded by the LCA, the former LCA. But those missionaries came from various backgrounds. Besides LCA missionaries, there were a couple of German, Scandinavian missionaries, I think four or five of them, and some Chinese pastors from Hong Kong. So it was a united mission then. And my first contact with the Christian mission at the age of 13 or 14 was that of rejection because of history, whatever reasons. But I think in the end, it was more the persistence and the patience and the friendship of these early pioneers of the Lutheran mission that sort of won our respect. And I think, to cut the story short, basically and finally, it was a reading of the gospel writings, especially the work and the words of Jesus. I think that was decisive in terms of my conversion. And that kind of story could be multiplied many times. So we, together with others, belong to the first generation of Lutherans in Malaysia and Singapore. And as I said the other day, when I talk about my story, I talk about this with a deep sense of gratitude, first of all, to God, and also to the pioneers of the Lutheran mission.
When you
yes.
were...
Lady first, I'm sure.
Still.
I was going to say, when we were in Singapore, I remember there was a lot of talk about separating.
Yes, it was 83,
Singapore,
right?
Singapore and Malaysia, they are now one church, but they were talking about...
Right.
Is that still just a talk? Or
yes.
Is it,
you came to us in 83, was it not? 1983?
No, 80... Yeah, 83.
83, right. So we had a nice dinner together. Okay, yes, when you were there some 6 years ago, there was indeed such a talk about separation. Now, Malaysia is an independent sovereign country, similarly Singapore, a city-state. But the church is called LCMS. Now, not to be confused with Missouri Synod. LCM, we would like to say LCMNS. Okay, Lutheran Church in Malaysia and Singapore. It's still one church for very obvious reason. We are still very small. For example, the Lutheran Church history in Singapore is exactly 30 years old this year. We began our work in 1959. So we are still one church. And it is better for us to stay one church because the Singapore churches, for economic reason, are more well-to-do, a little bit more able financially, and therefore, in that sense, able to provide a little bit of help to those smaller congregations back in Malaysia. Yeah.
Well, I'd like to know if you feel that as a Christian organization in Singapore,
yes,
you are in some way under scrutiny by the government of Singapore, and along with that, what types of infringements on the activities of the church exist in Malaysia?
Well, I think in Singapore, in terms of Christian activities, so far we have not feel any restriction. But of course, in terms of making pronouncements, those of us who are in this part of the world, and by the grace of God, have experienced greater freedom in terms of democracy. Perhaps have to look at that situation from another perspective. The church is free, but we have to be very alert, constantly on our guard when we do make political statements, because it is different from what you have experienced in terms of democracy. But otherwise, I think we do not have that much to complain, because Singapore is multi-religious. Now, talking about Mao Tai, let me tell you a short story, may I? Mao Tai is a very strong drink. Mao Tai is stronger than whiskey, is stronger than, what is the other? Brandy. Mao Tai is the kind of drink that Chairman Mao used to entertain guests. So when you talk about a multi-community, they may be thinking about you being a community of drunkards. So being someone who knows a little bit more of English language than American English, I would say multi, all right, rather than multi. So being multi-religious society, the government has to be seen to be very fair to all religious communities. For example, the conversion of Muslims is always a sensitive issue. Although there's nothing to stop us sharing the gospel with all religious communities. Now in Malaysia is another situation. As some of you may know, Malaysia is quite an Islamic society in the sense that Islam is a state religion. Now interestingly enough, the other big nation in Southeast Asia is Indonesia. Indonesia as a country has the largest Islamic community in the world. And yet, Islam is not a state religion. Although 80% or more of the population are Islamic. So Singapore, in a way, is sandwiched between two Islamic, much bigger nations. So we have to move within that kind of limits. I don't know whether I respond to your question.
Well,
please come up. Yeah.
Well, part of it is I know some groups, maybe we would think of them as sectarian rather than strictly Christian, have gotten into trouble in Singapore with the government. And the other aspect that in Malaysia, are the congregations of your church in Malaysia, are they made up largely of Chinese people?
Yes. Now, in Malaysia, in fact, there are two Lutheran churches. I talk about that branch of the Lutheran Church, which has traditionally more in fellowship or in partnership with the LCA, now ELCA. We are much younger. The Lutheran Church, of which I am a member, is basically, although not exclusively, a Chinese church in terms of population. But there is another church which is smaller, but older. That is a Tamil, Southern Indian church, and traditionally has a lot in common, or I think is a kind of a sister church of the Church of Sweden. All right, Church of Sweden. That is more an Indian church. I see one here. Yes, please.
Bishop Tutu, when he met with the North American delegation at the World Council of Churches in Vancouver, spoke of a great deal of compassion that he had for North Americans. And he said, I feel for you because it's so difficult for you to discern the gospel in your culture.
Yeah.
How do you see Christianity in a North American culture from an Asian perspective?
Yes. I perhaps shouldn't comment too much on Bishop Tutu's comment. I don't know exactly what he had in mind, you know, when he made that kind of statement. I would like to think that from an Asian perspective, it is much easier now to distinguish Christianity in a biblical sense from a kind of a folk religion or American culture. What I'm trying to say is, until recently, now we call this era, post-Christian era, it was very tempting for us outsiders as well as for Americans to identify Christianity too much or too closely with American culture. Now for many years, especially under the Reagan administration, people talk about moral majority. Well, that might be the case, but I don't think you can in reality talk very much about Christian majority in America, even today. Pardon me for saying that. If I judge Christianity by its witness, life, and dynamics, I do not think that you can identify Christianity so easily and so naturally with the American society. In other words, maybe one of these matters I may like to share tomorrow when I talk about Christian life and witness. I feel that we have a lot in common. You see, in Asia, we, in many situations, are in a minority situation. But I don't think that serious Christians are in majority situations either in the average cities in America. I do not like to sound offensive. In other words, I do not think that in any given city in the United States you have a Christian majority. I'm talking about real committed Christian disciples. They're nominal church members. In that sense, we have a lot in common in terms of comradeship. So it becomes more challenging for me as an Asian brother to talk about partnership in mission together with you. So I think Tutu may have a point there, but I think it is easier for me now, in my rather superficial understanding even of the American society, to tell now which is authentically Christian, which is not. But I think the average Americans do have difficulty because of the heritage to distinguish the two. So a kind of a folk religion, as you'll find in Germany or in Scandinavia, are quite prevailing, I suppose. I do not claim to understand a great deal of the society. This is my impression anyway.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah.
Should I press him a little further on that? You care to comment
please.
At all on, as an outside observer, on particular strengths, weaknesses even of the church, the Lutheran church in the USA?
Yes.
Or you don't have to. But
yeah, I think I would be very happy to talk more about that. Now, many of the Lutheran members in Asia, for example, know of ELCA or LCA through the Red Book, now the Green Book. You know, that's it. Because very few of them have personal contacts with American Lutheran brothers and sisters. I perhaps belong to the privileged few who had previous occasions, traveled quite extensively, and spoke to some global mission events, and spent a year in one of your good schools, not quite Lutheran, in Harvard. So that gave me that's right. And there, so I otherwise they have come to appreciate Lutheran church in America through the liturgies, the services, burial, marriage, and all this, you know, calendar, and it is very exciting, I must say. I do not say this out of in terms of flattery. I don't think you need any flattery from me as a brother from Asia. To see this kind of gathering, this to me is exciting in the sense that we may have a strong confessional base as Lutherans, but in our worship, in our sharing, in the poems, reading, you know, whether mealtime, sing song, and all this, I see a very vibrant Lutheran society. And this gives me tremendous encouragement. The kind of encouragement, as I said the other day, which is difficult to find if I visit West Germany or Scandinavia, perhaps I see a little bit more life and serious commitment to mission in Finland. I do not know, I may be. It's like compared with Church of Sweden gives me a very bad picture. I'm sorry, those of you whose ethnic background is Swedish. It's very unfair comparison. In terms of commitment to mission, from my understanding, I think some of the Finnish Lutherans, Norwegian Lutherans, are still very committed. But as a nation, they worry me a lot. I do not talk about this in any judgmental sense, but as one who is very conscious of being a member of the Lutheran World Federation. So in that sense, if you want me to put it very simply, I am more hopeful about ELCA, for example. I do not know about Missouri Synod in the future, but ELCA, as I would compare with, say, the European counterparts.
You know, push on the other side.
Yes.
And what do you wish more from our ELCA and Lutherans here in the USA? Where should we start facing some things?
All right. Let us give a concrete example. You have people coming to the States, United States, many of them coming as tourists, many in business, many as students, and some as scholars. And many, whether you like it or not, will come as migrants. All right. I kind of think that you have some difficulty. This is not just a Lutheran church problem, but the American church as a whole, coping with these people, particularly those students and thousands of them, and scholars, say from China, and migrants, I think you have difficulty, and I can appreciate some of the difficulties. Now, for example, some years ago, I was talking to one or two mission executives representing the LCA then about integration. You have migrants coming from Korea, Japan, Taiwan, Hong Kong. How do you encourage integration? All right. Now, of course, we are humble enough to recognize that in terms of integration is concerned, has been a failure. So in some quarters, I hear that people have accepted the fact that, well, maybe we have to start churches, ethnic, you know, emphasis. Can be a Korean Lutheran church, you know, Chinese Lutheran church. It is sad in terms of fellowship, but that is the kind of reality. I don't think you have an easy way out. And secondly, I feel that you have tremendous resources in many ways, financial resources, as well as manpower. I think with this in mind and with serious commitment to mission, it is still very meaningful as late as 1989 to talk about seriously partnership in mission. But I see one area, for example, in theological education, there are great possibilities for partnership in that. For example, in my small school, I would be very delighted to see some Lutheran candidates, theological candidates, to spend a year of internship or a term with us, not so much taking some courses, you know, standard courses, but for the exposure. I think this, a lot of areas, so I see great possibilities. So I'm very optimistic about that.
Could you tell us about your school?
Yes, I will be. I will come back to you again. I have not forgotten you.
But, yes. That's okay. Yes, go ahead, respond to that.
Yes, my school.
Train of thought.
Very simple. I think Dr. Pilgrim mentioned the fact that Trinity Theological College, in which I serve, is an ecumenical school, a United College. It began exactly in 1948, pioneered by three mission leaders. They happened to be missionaries, all three of them. They were in prison during the Japanese occupation, the Pacific War. I think these three church leaders, all three missionaries representing the Anglican, which is Episcopalian, Methodist, and Presbyterian. I think while in prison, I think they became more charitable to one another. I believe in God's, you don't have to be a Calvinist to believe in God's sovereignty, So it was in God's, I think, providence that these three heads of churches were put in the same prison cell, a very notorious Changi prison. Well, there they talk, very lovingly about ecumenical efforts. So they thought about a United College. Of course, the war ended in 1945. 3 years later, they started this college, Trinity Theological College. All right? And our church, Lutheran Church, became a partner in the early 60s. So we have a student population of 160. 42% of our students have come from overseas, representing about 10 nations. Majority of them from Malaysia, Indonesia, India, Sri Lanka, Japan, Taiwan, Korea. One student from California, Pasadena. Also, we have two students from Africa. Occasionally, we get students from Canada, New Zealand and Australia. So it's very international and very ecumenical. Besides students coming from the founding churches, Anglican, Presbyterian, Methodist, Lutheran, we also have people from Baptist background, free churches, even charismatic churches. It's quite exciting for me.
Is it all in English?
No, we have two departments. We have two departments. About 60% of the students are registered with the English department. In other words, using English as medium for instruction. The courses in two departments are identical. I teach in both departments, and a few of my colleagues who are bilingual handle both departments. And your question now?
when traveling in Malaysia, it was expressed to me by some Malaysians that this one person was part Chinese, and that this was sort of the lowest in the Malaysian group if you had Chinese in you.
Oh, yes, yes.
Okay, so does this show up in your relationship with Malaysians at all or not?
Yeah, now in Malaysia, the major ethnic groups are the Malays. Now the Malays, in terms of language and background, are very similar to Indonesians, all right? They speak a similar language, so Malay. And the great majority of the Malays, in fact, I would say easily 99% of them are Muslims, all right? And Muslims, all right? And this would be followed by Chinese and some tribal groups, Indians and this. And because the political power is in the hand of the Malays or the Muslims, you have the kind of difficulty in terms of privileges, in terms of discriminations. You do have those problems. I think you are quite right. If you are not a Muslim, you can find yourself in a rather disadvantaged situation. I dare not say much about this because this was considered, or has been considered, a very sensitive issue. If those of us who are in the other part of Malaysia, Singapore, if we talk a little bit too much on that kind of subject, that could be considered as interference in the internal affairs of the Malaysian government. Yes, but it does exist, as it exists in many other places. Yes. You know? It's a very common problem.
Dr. Chung.
Yes.
I was trying to speak to you yesterday of inclusivity. I think you approached part of this question. When we speak of, we put a description on a group of people and say Asian, and say that we're going to get all these Asians to do something together. Mm-hmm. We sometimes may forget that these Asians have their own categories of people within.
Right.
How, in my job, my type of job, bringing people together to work, would you speak to a common cause type situation?
Yes. Yes, I think bringing Asians of diverse backgrounds together is not an easy task. For example, I don't think it is necessarily easier for Japanese and Chinese, both Asians, to work together. In fact, I am tempted to say that it may be easier for a Chinese or a Chinese congregation to cooperate better with the American. I mean, pardon me for saying the word, using the word white. A white congregation.
Your part.
Yeah, then. then Chinese and Japanese working together, you know? And similarly, it would be very hard for Korean Lutherans and Japanese Lutherans to work together for various reasons. So the fact that they are all Chinese doesn't mean very much. But I think you have a point there. But if there is a common cause, a common ground, it would be very good for these various groups to share together with our brothers and sisters from, you know, America, whether they're native Indians, whether they're colored people or white people. I think in the Christian Fellowship there is such a great possibility.
Give us a bit of insight, if you would, also to the age stratification, meaning the older person relating to the younger person may be in a situation of two passes, one older, one younger.
Yeah. I think the age difference is a matter. The other area may be language. I think one of the difficulties for you in your coping with migrants or immigrants is language. More so with the older people, older Vietnamese, older Chinese, older Koreans. I think the younger ones usually would have less difficulty picking up the language. So if you have a congregation with say two pastors, one more senior in age, the other one younger, I think it may be easier, for example. I don't think age is a big problem there, provided these migrant groups have the language facilities. They feel very isolated. I have occasions interviewing and talking to migrants, especially coming from Taiwan and Hong Kong, the Chinese, and many of them Christians. But they feel very much isolated. For example, unlike Taiwan, unlike Hong Kong, many of them, the older ones, do not have the free access to the language, and therefore the TV programs, newspapers, friendship, you know, neighborhood, a strange place, very strange place. It is not so much that many of them actually like coming to this part of the world. I think there are those who are more adventurous, still are very romantic about this promised land of USA. Many had come over, I think, with very little choice. So I have great sympathy for these people. Well, I enjoy very much coming to you, sharing with you, and learning a lot together with you. But if you were to ask me, are you interested in coming to the States, even if the Foreign Office would give me a green card or something like that, as far as I'm concerned now, I'm just not interested. I would be very interested to share with my brothers and sisters in the States, but not coming as a citizen. I feel that in Asia at this time, it's very challenging. So it is not true that all Asians are interested in coming, because I'm sure you know that even those of us from Scandinavian, German backgrounds, or from other parts of Europe, our forefathers didn't enjoy coming to this part of the world. It was out of socio-political reasons that they landed here and make good out of it, you know. So I think Asian migrants need some understanding. I'm almost pleading for them, although I'm not one of them. Many of them came over as opportunists, you know, adventurous. Yes, quite a lot of them like that. But I think the great majority have been prompted by other factors. So I think they are sojourners and exiles in our land. I think it is very biblical for us to be hospitable to these people as a Christian community.
I'd like to take advantage of your having been to China recently.
Yes.
Going to China this next month. If you would give maybe your lectures, will do this, some thumbnail sketch of the Christian church in China and also their identification mm-hmm. with the aspirations of the
yes.
students.
The Chinese church is a very problematic matter. Some of you may know, in your visit to China, if you go through the official channel, through the ELCA office, Global Mission Division, you get in touch with the official church, all right? Which has its headquarters in Nanking or Nanjing, led by Bishop K.H. Ting, called the Three Self Church. But that is only one section of the Chinese church. There is also Christians in China who would rather consider themselves as free church members, sometimes described as house church. The word underground was used, but was a very bad term. You know? It has a lot of negative connotations. Underground could imply subversive, and that is a bad word for the Chinese government. You know? So a lot of them would like to say, now we are not members of the Three Self Open Church. We are members of the house church, in other words, unofficial church. And they are very sizable in number. We do not know how many. But this I do know. Before the communists took over in 1949, according to some reliable records that we have had, the total Chinese population protesting in China in 1949 was only 700,000, not quite 1 million, 700,000. Now, last year, when I was in China, I was given an official figure, 6 million. Now, that is considered very conservative. And some would like to put it as high as 10 million or more, depending who is doing what. So it's a big church. Big, not in terms of percentage, you know. What is 10 million, you know, with 1 billion or more? That is still very small. But if you had 10 million Christians, that is bigger than our ELCA. ELCA has something like 6 million, is that right? Missouri Synod, about 2 million or more. So imagine, it's good to imagine that all the Lutherans in the States, including Missouri Synod, would be, for convenience sake, 10 million. Now that would be about the size of the Chinese church, all right? And some would say less or more. I would like to think that more. And that is in terms of statistics. In terms of church life, it's very hard to know. I saw a documentary not so long ago about some of the house churches. There is no question about growth and life, the moving of the Spirit. But many of these free churches do not have strong confessional base, because denomination doesn't mean anything now, at least for the time being. And they are very charismatic, and they rally around some charismatic figures. And that can be very dangerous if they are not given balanced, solid, biblical teaching. So I have a mixed feeling, you know, thinking about China. They have, let me see, must be about 10 theological schools now in different places. And in most churches that you visit, the pastors are very old. 60 years of age is considered a very young pastor. I mean, that is not surprising at all, because after 49, for nearly 40 years, they hardly had opportunities training young pastors. Now, in my many visits to China, with the exception of the first one, when I visited China in my official capacity, together with two Lutheran World Federation executives, otherwise I try not to identify, honestly, too closely with these churches, whether open churches or the house churches, because my first invitation to China to teach came from the university and with the endorsement of the government, and I certainly had to be very cautious not to be seen as one coming, you know, under that kind of pretext to do, you know, straightforward evangelistic sort of work. Although I did have many occasions talking quite freely with my students who took the initiative to ask me more about my Christian faith.
Would you, Dan?
Yeah, you better monitor.
Yeah, Dan, go ahead.
Would you comment on your inter-religious dialogue and what some of the issues are in talking to other religions in Asia?
You almost anticipated my talk tonight or tomorrow about dialogue. More tomorrow. Doesn't matter. You can hear it twice. I will put it in slightly different versions. Yes, that is true. I mentioned the fact that we in Malaysia and Singapore are in multi or multi-religious contexts. And religious dialogue is not just academic. It is day-to-day life activities. For example, in my college, our gardener is a Muslim, right? One of our office staff, a lady, is a Buddhist. Our newspaper man, the one who delivers very faithfully newspapers to us every day without fail, is a Hindu. Now, even my own father-in-law, a good man, is still a Buddhist. Although I had many occasions sharing with him the gospel, we are still praying for him. All right, so it is in that kind of context that we talk about religious dialogue also. And very often I feel that religious dialogues that are being conducted in academic circles or in Geneva or from Geneva are too academic. They are not in touch with the real world situation. Now, in my interest in art, you mentioned about that, I serve as the secretary of the Singapore Art Society, which is quite a big society. I do that for two reasons, because painting, fine arts, has always been my interest, my hobby. And secondly, I feel that as a Christian worker, I shouldn't be isolated from the society at large. So by involving in the Singapore Art Society, together with the Harvard Club of Singapore and societies like this, I have ample opportunities being in touch with people of other religious traditions and backgrounds. And many of my Chinese friends, the artists, visual arts, performance arts are actually Buddhist Confucianists. It's very, very meaningful. And that reminds me of Peter's advice in 1 Peter, chapter 3, I believe, when he talks about be ready to make a defense for the gospel. The word used is apologia. When people ask you the reason of your hope, but doing it with gentleness and with reverence. Now that is very challenging to me. And very often, I think we take a very aggressive, evangelistic approach. You know, and that there is a place for that. I don't want to be misunderstood. In many cases, we as Christians should certainly take the initiative, sharing the gospel freely with the non-believers. But in many occasions, I felt that they took the initiative asking me about the reason of my hope, for example, about matters. That gave me tremendous opportunities to share with them. So religious dialogues, I would like to think, is more productive in that situation. That is not to exclude intellectual dialogue on a higher plane or level. I don't know whether it answers your question. It's a very exciting place because daily in your contact with people, you meet people of other religious traditions.
Well, my question is related to that. I'm just wondering, what is the nature of relationship of Christianity in Singapore mm-hmm. with the other religions? Is there an attitude among Christians of exclusive that Christians are right and they are wrong? Or is there some kind of looking for a common ground?
Yeah, that kind of situation you see, I believe, in this part of the world also, is it not? I mean, in the United States, if you ask the fundamentalists, well, they will not give a damn to any dialogue. To them, it's a waste of time. That is an extreme. The other could be so generous, at least superficially, and in the end becomes so syncretistic, and there is no Christian basis to talk about. So these are two extremes. I think I would like to think that in Singapore, the extremists, happily in this case, belong to the minority. I think the majority of the Christians are realistic about it, saying that while we do hold on to our own faith, Christian faith, very dearly, we have a Christian perspective, we take our own Christian stand very seriously, there is also openness in terms of, first of all, understanding others' faiths, and with that understanding, on that security, be open enough even to dialogue and making it meaningful, you know. Is it possible for me, seeing that this is a dialogue, not a question and answer session, to ask you one or two questions?
You only got 11 minutes.
Oh, yes, yes. Every now and then, when we meet with brothers and sisters, I mean Christians, whether Lutheran or not, from North America, and some of them were very kind, very open, saying that, well, it's mission in global context. America itself is a mission field, you know. We would appreciate having even missionaries, evangelists coming from outside of the United States. Well, I think many of them said it out of sincerity, and I appreciate those gestures very much. But is it realistic, for example, are our congregations, the majority of our ELCA or Missouri Synod congregations, ready for a pastor, say coming from Hong Kong or somewhere in Singapore, to serve you as your pastor? In other words, me, as someone not quite white but yellow, you know, yeah. Serving you who are fairer. I mean, is it just something romantic, or is it?
I noticed when we had our city convention down in Vancouver, the pastor of the Catholic Church, where we had the closing Eucharist, because only the Catholic Church was large enough, the pastor there was, I believe, Vietnamese, which was kind of a nice surprise. Mm-hmm. He greeted us, and so at least in that, in the Roman Catholic Church, there, or in that one place,
Has there been some test cases, so to speak, so that enough basis for us to analyze the situations, the pros and cons, the difficulties, and the more encouraging side of the story? Do we have?
I feel, of course, this is a little different because Mexico is so close to us.
Yes.
And I'm from Southern California, where we have a lot of the Mexicans. And I feel whenever we go to try include the Mexicans in with us, then it's typical for a Spanish person to come in, mm-hmm. not to serve us, but to serve them. And so then you become a divided church again. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if this couldn't happen too. You say that a lot of the immigrants here are so unhappy here and don't feel that they're being integrated in, if the same thing wouldn't happen. But we just come right out and are pretty brash, where you are like this, you know. Do we offend you the way we come at you?
No. In fact, I must say in all honesty that the great majority of our Lutheran missionaries, talking about Malaysia and Singapore, served very well and were well accepted, well respected. Now that may have a lot to do with the cultural background of Asian societies, because like teachers, you know, teachers are well respected in the Chinese society, for example. Similarly, pastors are usually regarded as people of that level. So when you come as a missionary pastor, even you are white, a foreigner coming to Malaysia and Singapore, you can be quite sure, you can take for granted that there is the minimum respect for someone, you know, in his position or in her position as a pastor or evangelist. Now, I do not know whether culturally that could be expected. I would like to think that it's very different. From that much I know about students in the university in relation to their professors. I think, for example, now, like this, now, I will say this in a matter of just good humor. Don't take me too seriously. Now, for example, in the lecture situation in Asia, or at least in Malaysia and Singapore, for students to raise their legs like this, yeah, no, please, no problem. And in front of the professors, it's quite a taboo.
Oh, yes.
None of the students, no student in my class, not that I discourage that, if they raise their leg like this, I don't think I take it too seriously. Mm-hmm. I would gently give them a smile and they would got the message. So it's not offensive to me. It's not offensive to me at all, because I was overseas, you know. I spent 3 years in Britain and in Australia and in the States. So to me it's nothing at all. It's just a gesture. But of course in the States, you know, I think that would be considered, you know, being equal, and you address your professor by the Christian name. Oh no, you never do that. In China, in Hong Kong, or certainly not in Japan or Korea. You never
when
address...
When were the missionaries put out of China? When were the Lutheran missionaries kicked out of China?
Well,
was that 40?
49 or soon after 49, about that. They simply couldn't stay. Mm-hmm. What I'm saying is, there is a cultural difference here. What I'm saying is, an Asian pastor coming to serve with an American congregation, we have to take that into consideration. Mm-hmm. Although the congregation can be very warm, very friendly to the pastor, but in most cases, you cannot assume that you are coming as a teacher pastor. You know, I think they have to do a lot of adjusting. A lot of adjusting. But what I'm interested is just in concept. There's nothing to stop, isn't it, for someone coming.
I think, as you said to us,
yes,
about the immigrant populations, for example, the Laotians and
yes,
the Vietnamese from our country, the issue would be language.
It's one of the major issues, yes.
Sure, and if a pastor came into one of the congregations that I'm serving,
oh, yes,
who is born and educated in Asia, I know the concern that my people would ask immediately is, do they speak my language? Mm-hmm. If this person speaks my language, then we can
move
from there.
Even if language facilities is there, there are still a lot of difficulties. Mm-hmm. Let me give you a concrete example. When I was at Harvard, I stayed in Boston area, Brookline, all right, a good suburb, Brookline. And I saw two congregations, very active Chinese-speaking congregations. In this case, it's certainly not because of language. In fact, it is a very educated congregation. They operate in a place called Woburn in Massachusetts. A big congregation, literally about 500 members worshiping every Sunday. Literally, there are dozens of PhDs from MIT and Harvard. It's very exceptional. Majority of them have come from Taiwan. Those who are 40 and below speak like American, with even with amusing American accent. So language is no problem.
Bostonian,
that's right. So they still would not like to go to an English-speaking, English congregation or American congregation, sorry, you know what I mean? So it's far more than just language. It's the kind of sense of identity with people of your own. That perhaps explains a lot as to why there is a Norwegian Lutheran church, Swedish, German, isn't it? Augustana and all this, which is very confusing to me. You know? So it is just human, very human.
Well, I would just think back to the question, what would I think if you came and acted as my pastor,
yes,
and to give you authority? And I would think that deep down inside, mm-hmm, I still have racist tapes, excuse me,
yes,
running through my head.
I'm glad you told me that.
And I have to make adjustments.
That's true.
And because I'm more conscious of it now, I'm able to do that without being too shocked with myself.
Yes.
And I went to a Chinese doctor, mm-hmm, and I ran these tapes through my head. Mm-hmm. And on other occasions, and then I say, where does that come from? Oh, I know where it comes from. Mm-hmm. And then I can deal with it.
Yes.
But I think we have to say it,
yes,
and
sure,
and be honest about it. Mm-hmm. And then I can give you the respect, yeah, that God gave you, or I mean that I should,
sure,
give you.
Sure. Yeah, so it
but
is.
But I can't lie about,
yeah,
it.
That's true. It is give and take, isn't it? On both parties, isn't,
yes,
it? I think so. I think that is very true. Yeah.
I think as far as prejudice is concerned, we're all,
yes,
some area or other, we're prejudiced. But I think one area where somebody like you could be a tremendous help to us is, say, at Harvard. If you were called to be chaplain at Harvard, I, for one, have a real burden for these students that come and are going to go back to their country, mm-hmm, and be the leaders when they get there. And
yeah,
are we, as a Christian church, say nothing about being Lutheran church, what are we doing for them? Mm. And that area, I think we need lots of help. Say our university in Seattle,
right,
or, you know, this is all the way across, yeah, the country.
Yes.
We have thousands of,
yes,
students.
Yes.
What are we doing for them?
That's true. Mm.
And I think that we do have, mm-hmm, have pastors, Lutheran pastors on many of these universities.
Yes, yes.
But are they doing the job that someone like you could do for the students that, I mean, you could meet them in their own language. And I think that would be an area that would be a tremendous help to us.
Yes. Thank you, Pastor, for mentioning that. I think that is an area which we may have to consider very seriously, because students are not here to stay, they are here for a few years.
Right.
And many of them, say from China, scholarship holders, they go back and assume very responsible position. So it is a very strategic area of ministry. I think it is the kind of ministry that is meaningful for us to talk about, even partnership together.
Yes.
For example, by pooling common resources together. Yes, I will have to think about it seriously, honestly. Thank you for mentioning that. Now, sister, I overlooked your question you were about to.
I was
Please.
just going to ask about women. If a woman was to go to your homeland, how would a woman be received as a, say, just a missionary or a pastor?
Oh, yes.
How would you... How would the culture receive
them? Well, they fared very well. In fact, I mentioned about in the early 50s, it was a United Lutheran Mission. Some from Scandinavia, some from Germany, some from Hong Kong, majority from United States. And amongst these pioneer missionaries were, let me see, four. I used to know very, very intimately. One served as a nurse from Norway. All right, one from the States, also a nurse. One came as an English teacher. The other one came as a missionary. No problem about that. As missionaries, as teachers. Of course, although the ordination of women varies from church to church, that is another issue. But being women as such is certainly not a stumbling block at all in that society. Well, if you talk about Singapore, Singapore is a very cosmopolitan society. In fact, Singapore, the kind of openness, exposure, is far greater than the average towns in the States. You see, because by virtue of the being, you know, it being a communication center. Now, it was interesting 2 days ago or 3 days ago when in New Jersey, staying with in the house of a relative, I saw this, the tour of duty, right? Series on. Is being shown for about 2 or 3 months now in Singapore. So in other words, we get a lot of news and a lot of information. Perhaps being a city-state in Singapore, for example, we know more about you, in general, than the average, say, American student know about us. You see, I can quite understand because you are such a big, great country. You can afford to forget about us. But we have to live together with you. We are stuck with you. You see, our share market goes, the Wall Street, you know, journal is so important to us because the share market in Wall Street goes up and down and our hearts goes up and down. Because, see, our dollar, our Singapore dollar is tied to gold and to the US dollar. The share market, the international and multinational corporations and all this are together. So we feel more that we are together with you. Although a lot of Americans, you know, feel that, well, we can be ourselves. Now, I can go on and on.
Stop, and I have an appropriate way to end. All put your feet down.